Soviet states settled their long-standing conflict. Putin said he's hopeful that the summit will make it possible to outline steps to resolve the Nagorno-Karabakh issue, adding the Armenian leadership has the political will to resolve the conflict with Azerbaijan. Putin, however, noted Moscow does not impose anything on anyone and only offers a peaceful solution.
I know that you have the political will for this, and we support it in every possible way. We must find the key points that will allow us to move forward. This conflict has been going on for decades, so we still need to end it sometime.
Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan reacted to Putin's remarks, voicing his readiness to accept Moscow's offer to establish diplomatic relations with Baku. Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev also said that the Karabakh conflict has already become history and it is time to talk about the normalization of relations between Yerevan and Baku. He expressed gratitude to Russia for trying to resolve the issue. Some experts believe the U.S. and some European countries, particularly France, are trying to foment discord between Armenia from Russia, reform their friendly relations to hostility, withdraw Armenia from the CSTO, and encourage Yerevan for a new large-scale military conflict with Azerbaijan.
France is actively intervening in the conflict. NATO's interests are visible behind it. The USA has one of its largest embassies in Yerevan, the same with Azerbaijan. There goes Israel and the UK. The latter is one of Turkey's closest friends. Another bloc of countries is being formed there, but they all work in the same direction. They are opposed to the participation of Iran and Russia in resolving this conflict and are trying to replace the participation of neighboring states with that of Western ones. This deprives the people of Armenia and Azerbaijan of a peaceful solution.
A six-week war between Azerbaijan and Armenia in 2020, which claimed the lives of more than 6,500 troops on both sides, ended with a Russian brokered deal that saw Yerevan cede swathes of territory that it had controlled for several decades. Last month, 286 people from both sides were killed in the flare-up of new clashes.
Moscow's task is to find ground for a compromise. The interference of Turkey, France, Britain and the United States in the Armenian-Azerbaijani relations in recent months, the so-called Western Peace Project may simply threaten the disappearance of Nagorno-Karabakh. Most experts believe the mediation of such countries is a trap from which there is no way out. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Ukrainian army says Russia has hit the country with a volley of 55 cruise missiles as well as other ammunition. The army says that the Monday attacks hit civilian targets. Ukraine's presidential advisor has described the strikes as one of the largest since the war began in February. Officials say the strikes left hundreds of areas across Ukraine without power. The Russian President Vladimir Putin says the attack was a partial response to drone strikes on the country's Black Sea fleet. Putin says Russia could have done more. Putin has blamed Ukraine for the attack that prompted Moscow to suspend a deal to allow Ukraine gain exports despite the war. Our correspondent is on the ground in Crimea. He earlier joined us with more details about the situation.
Last night, I spoke to a contact of mine who is from Kiev. She told me that the situation for Kiev residents is becoming more and more difficult. The mayor, Vitaly Klitschko, of course, says that 80% of people in Kiev no longer have running water due to these Russian strikes. So in the future, we may well start to see more refugees leaving Ukraine, fleeing to Europe, which in turn may well put more policy on European government, more pressure on European governments. So this war not only being fought on the battlefield, but also to influence public opinion and to pressure European governments to change their policy on Ukraine.
The Russian president is calling on Ukraine to guarantee the safety of the Black Sea traffic after Moscow suspended participation in a UN-brokered grain shipment deal. Vladimir Putin accused Kiev of using the shipping corridor for an attack on Russia's Crimea fleet. Russian Defense Ministry also called on the UN to obtain the required guarantees from Ukraine. Moscow says that the decision to halt the implementation of the deal was prompted by a Ukrainian drone attack on Russian ships in Crimea. Kiev has dismissed the allegation as a false pretext. Russia's move has also angered Ukraine's Western allies. The U.S. has called the move purely outrageous. Also, the EU and the NATO have discussed that have asked Russia to reverse its decision. The Western military alliance urged Russia to stop, quote, weaponizing food. Tensions are growing between the EU and the U.S. over trade-related matters. Brussels claims that measures introduced by Washington to fight inflation will damage EU firms. There is also growing disquiet over the price of America charging the EU for its gas, Jerome Hughes reports.
Importing liquefied natural gas from the U.S. is costing the EU a fortune, and leaders across the 27-nation bloc are looking for a better deal. EU trade ministers met on Monday. They are also not happy with Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. It includes state aid for American manufacturers that will put EU car builders at a disadvantage.
I will be pretty frank. I think in the form how it was presented, I think for the European Union is unacceptable.
This is all happening due to Western sanctions against Russia. Inflation is out of control. We've asked the European Commission why it's not trying to broker peace between Russia and Ukraine.
It just seems to be not on the agenda at all. Am I completely off the mark in that regard?
We have always said that whoever can use its influence to stop the war in Russia and to make to stop the war in Ukraine, we will support this.
EU trade ministers accuse Russia of using food as a weapon after Moscow left a UN-negotiated deal to facilitate grain shipments from Ukraine. It follows drone attacks on Russia's Black Sea fleet near Sevastopol on Saturday. The Kremlin blames Kiev, helped by British experts. Eurozone inflation has climbed to a new record high of 10.7%. EU leaders are being urged to tackle a growing social crisis in the bloc.
It is in the hand of the decision makers because it is very easy to solve this problem, and it is a shame for the European Union and for the member states.
Many claim the West could have prevented the war in Ukraine by listening to Russia's security concerns surrounding the issue of NATO expansion. Massive public protests are forecast as wages in the EU fail to keep up with soaring inflation. Already here in Belgium, police have agreed to hold a one-day strike on the 9th of November. The country's firefighters have announced they will do the same in December. A date for that has yet to be announced. It's set to be a winter of discontent for EU governments. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Germany and France are alarmed over a new trade law in the U.S. that makes investment in the country overtly competitive. Washington's new tax cuts and energy benefits for companies investing there have prompted strong reactions from German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and the French President Emmanuel Macron.
The German Chancellor and the French President met in Paris to recalibrate their relations, as there seems to be a rise in tensions over issues related to energy, economy and defense between Europe's two biggest economies. Germany and France are the driving forces behind many of the key decisions made by the European Union, such as a plan to raise billions of euros in debt to cushion the blow of the pandemic.
We are the biggest supporter of Europe. We are paying 26% of the budget usually, and we are developing a lot of solidarity mechanisms, as we did in the last crisis, looking at Corona, with the instruments we developed with the RRF and the recovery fund is a good chance for acting together also in the time we have now.
But amongst the differences in their policies that have become cause for fallouts, Scholz and Macron seem to be on the same page when it comes to seeing European investments being hijacked by the US as a result of new policies in Washington. Macron believes that as businesses are given incentive to, quote, buy American, France will lose 8 billion euros. What Macron is referring to exactly is the biggest climate and energy package in U.S. history, recently signed by Joe Biden. The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, or the IRA, includes $600 billion in spending in total, with $370 billion dedicated to supporting renewable energy and climate resilience. Washington is hoping to find the budget for the package by sorting out large corporations' long-running tax evasions, as well as those of the top 1%. Whether or not the corporations and the elite will still be able to evade taxes, as they've been doing for so long, remains to be seen, though. One of the measures in the IRA includes tax rebates for buyers of American-made electric vehicles, among many other industry credits for clean energy initiatives. These incentives will move operations from France to the U.S. to take advantage of these subsidies, according to Macron. He's even called the IRA measures unfairly protectionist. There is agreement among the EU bloc members that tangible and concrete measures need to be taken. Among the potential responses that the EU could give to the IRA policy is filing a complaint to the World Trade Organization that would call for adding European-made products to become a part of the U.S. rebate plan.
North Korea has called on the United States and South Korea to stop their joint large-scale military drills. It is warning that the war games are a provocation that may draw more powerful follow-up measures. The foreign ministry said the situation on the Korean Peninsula has entered a serious confrontation phase due to, quote, reckless U.S.-South Korea military moves. The ministry warned that Washington and Seoul have to take the blame for all the consequences if they do not stop their military exercises all at once. The U.S. and South Korea began one of their largest joint military air drills on Monday. The operation will run until Friday and will feature about 240 warplanes. Washington and Seoul say Pyongyang may be about to resume testing of nuclear bombs for the first time since 2017, and that is why they are holding the drills. Pyongyang, however, views the drills as a rehearsal for an invasion. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
in the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that the suspicious death of Imam Khomeini's elder son, Haj Aqa Mustafa, was a serious event in the course of the Islamic Revolution and highly impacted the family members of the Imam. Yet, Imam Khomeini himself treated the event very calmly as if nothing had happened. Today, we are going to speak to you on the Imam's departure to Paris. Stay with us, please. As the family of Imam Khomeini was getting prepared for the first anniversary of Haj Aqa Mustafa's martyrdom, the Ba'athist regime in Iraq decided to expel the Imam. Imam Khomeini, however, was not intent to capitulate to the demands of the Iraqi regime. Thus, he made up his mind to go to Kuwait. But the Kuwaiti government was forced by the Iranian dictatorial regime to reject the Imam's request. Therefore, after a brief stay on the Kuwaiti border, Imam Khomeini consulted with Haj Ahmad and accepted to go to Paris. The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, says, "The night when the Imam wanted to leave for Kuwait was a strange night. Everyone was at our home. Everywhere was quiet. We slept at 12. Nearly 2 hours later, the Imam woke up for midnight prayer. It was peculiar. As soon as the Imam got up, everyone got up except children, as if no one had slept. Imam Khomeini got up to do his routine night job, ritual, ablution, midnight prayer, supplication and recitation of Quran. At that night, everyone was performing midnight prayer. Ahmad went to inform the friends who were supposed to accompany the Imam to Kuwait. He found all of them from the alleys of Najaf. They too had either not slept the night or just had fearfully taken a rest for an hour. Everybody was ready. Ahmad asked the Imam, 'Shall we not go?' The Imam answered, 'A quarter is left to the due time.'" Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, left Iraq without his wife and other women of his family. The women were supposed to stay in Najaf until conditions would become proper for joining the Imam. Lady Saghafi relates the story of the night when the Imam left them. "Everyone was doing something. I was preparing the foodstuff for the journey. Bread, cheese, walnut, and cuckoo. Imam Khomeini bid farewell to everyone. When it was my turn, he cast a deep look at me and said, 'I put you under God's care. It is nothing. We cannot disobey God. These people want to force me to give in. But pray that we move in the right way.' I let the Imam pass under the Quran and Ahmad followed him." She continues, "For 3 days, the workers outdoors thought that the Imam is at home. On the third day, when our Afghani worker understood that what happened, he wept so intensively. At first, I thought that they knew and was surprised as I saw no reaction from them. Then it was clear that they had not known. The house was plunged in silence. Everyone went to a corner. Some were crying quietly. Their pillows were plunged in tears, but there was no voice. Nobody had heard the sound of our hearts breaking. The departure of Imam Khomeini and the unknown future condition was very worrisome for his family, particularly for his wife. Nevertheless, some of their friends not only didn't help them to endure tough conditions better, but they added salt to their injury by censuring them. The Imam's wife recounts, when the Imam left Najaf for Kuwait and then Paris, some of the wives of ulema asked, "Why did the Imam do this? Isn't it a pity to leave the holy Najaf and go to the land of disbelief? How can one compare the divine neighborhood of Imam Ali with Paris, the land of debauchery and unfaith? It was meaningless for them to see a source of emulation to go to France, as they didn't find it rational. For them, it was better to die in Najaf, even if it was with silence against the oppression, to living freely in Paris. Some of them thought that what made the Imam to go to Paris was his inattention to other sources of emulation, so that it would be said in history he acted differently to become conspicuous among others." Ms. Saghafi relates her last pilgrimage to the shrine of Imam Hussein and Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas, peace upon them. "Any time that I went on pilgrimage of Imam Hussein and Hazrat Abul Fazl, I would ask them to accept me once more to visit them. I would pray and they would accept. But the last time I forgot to ask them my usual request, thus I didn't find the opportunity to visit them anymore." 10 days after Imam Khomeini's departure to Kuwait and Paris, the preparations were made for the trip of his wife and other members of the family. The Imam's wife says, "Upon the Imam's departure, we started collecting everything to join him after holding the first anniversary of my son's martyrdom. I had no sorrow except leaving my son. Ahmad telephoned me and told me to go to France with Hussein. The tickets were taken for 4 days later, and we spent 4 days to gather everything. We would spend the nights to bid farewell to the commander of the faithful and my son Mustafa. I couldn't go to Karbala anymore. On the 14th of Dhulqa'dah, we left Najaf for Paris. I and my grandson Hussein went to Paris and then to Nufal Chateau. Ahmad welcomed us at the airport. We had the lunch at Mr. Karim Khoda Panahi's home and went to the Imam in the afternoon. 3 days later, a house was taken for us. It was the house of Mr. Askari. It was the so-called bureau. The little appliances that had been prepared also belonged to the homeowner."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The former Brazilian president Lula da Silva has defeated left-wing former leader Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil's presidential elections. Although the far-right incumbent has yet to concede, Brazilians are out celebrating this historic and very close win. Given that Bolsonaro won't contest the results and the transformation to take place, well, what issues stand tall for Lula da Silva? The economy, foreign policy, Latin American integration? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will ask those questions from our guests and also look at what to expect from Lula da Silva on the world stage, especially when it comes to the U.S. and as a member of BRICS countries, in terms of its relations, particularly with China. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Bruno Biclini, academic and political scientist, joins us from Porto Alegre in Brazil. Also joining us, Arnold August, author and journalist, who joins us from Montreal. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Let me first go to Porto Alegre in Brazil and ask you, Bruno Biclini, is this a good day for Brazil?
Oh, thanks for the invitation. Yes, I would say so. Brazil is very relieved. It's very much more tranquilized because as long as we fix to the manual of political science, an administration like Bolsonaro has a tendency to go in a more proto-fascist way. And also we, 16 million Arab Brazilians community in Brazil, we are very more calm because, example, yesterday, Michelle Bolsonaro, the first lady, went to vote using a T-shirt supporting Israel, supporting Zionist apartheid. So for us, the time for victory today, to getting rid of the fascists and also defeating Zionism in our own country.
I'm sorry, I got to ask you this. Why were they wearing a T-shirt supporting Israel? And because I have to ask this, supporting Israel and the apartheid regime that it is.
Yeah, because they are pro-Zionists. They are pro-apartheid. They have the support of seven big enterprises, very big, huge companies, so-called neo-Pentecostal churches, who are supporters for Israel, just like the Bible Belt in the U.S. supports the occupying of Palestine, the occupation in Palestine. So for us, we are 60 million Arab Brazilians in this country. We will have a minister. The vice president is an Arab, Alckmin. The future minister, Haddad.
Interesting.
The Senator Simone Tebet. We are very glad to defeating the Zionists in our country. They supported this fascist president like Bolsonaro, and they supported his policies here. It's a good day for us.
Well, that's since our guest has mentioned that, Arnold August, it's quite a contrast to Jair Bolsonaro to Lula da Silva in so many ways. That's just one prime example. I'm not too sure how prime it is in the scale of things. So I want to ask you how Brazilians are now viewing this, because many are saying a reference to the past is being made in terms of a nostalgia of the good days when you had Lula da Silva, who was in power between 2003 and 10, had such an impact in terms of improving the economy, especially for the poor, and things were going well at that point. Do you think he can pull it off again, given the current political and economic landscape that exists today?
Yeah.
No, this is for Arnold August. I'm sorry. I'll get to you with the same question.
Sorry, Arnold
August.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm very happy that the other guest mentioned that T-shirt with the Israeli flag. I also saw it, and it goes a long way to indicate to us the differences between the two candidates. And, you know, my basic reaction, of course, that millions of people, especially in the global south, as well as progressive people in the west, we are overjoyed by the defeat of Bolsonaro and the victory of Lula. Of course, it's going to be difficult, because aside from the fact that he won by only a small margin, the reports coming, for example, from your Latin American correspondent in Latin America, in Brazil at this time, Camila Escalante, I just saw her Twitter feed, and we see on the streets in Brazil that there are the Bolsonaro followers are organizing blockades of blockading roads, as well as burning tires and screaming, you know, we don't want to be invaded by communism. So we know that for sure that da Silva has...
Why communism? What is the meaning behind that, Arnold August?
Well, it's very simple. Right from the beginning, Bolsonaro, his main plank was what? Oh, Lula is going to bring communism to
in reference
Brazil.
To China, you mean?
No, I think it's mainly a reference, for example, to Venezuela or to Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, and Cuba, of course. Their main, when they talk about communism, it's not China. Because Brazil, even Bolsonaro, he has very close ties with China. I think, in my view, it's mainly playing on any prejudice people may have with regard to the governments in Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Cuba. But, you know, so despite all this, he did win. At the same time, you know, Bolsonaro, one has to say that his followers won the some of the most important state governorship. For example, Sao Paulo, the most important state in Brazil, the Bolsonaro won that. So, you know, aside from the, you know, what is going on in the streets, these are some of the challenges that Lula has to face.
Okay, so let's talk about those challenges, but briefly, if we can, and I need to ask you that, Bruno Bicolini, in terms of the what we read all the way up to this point, which I still think is going to exist based on what we have read about Brazil, and that's this extreme polarization that exists in the country. We thought that the margin of win for Lula would be a lot more, but it wasn't. We're looking almost a straight 50% that are on either side of the aisle. So does that pose a particular challenge for Lula at this point, given that he has won, and how he would approach it, in your opinion?
Well, we must understand that the powers that be in Brazil, the at least the half of this, of the major part of it, recognizes on Lula the victory and recognizes that he will be the rule of law. It's something very weird in Brazil. The uprising comes from the ultra-right wing. And also, we must understand that Brazil has been attacked like a fake war to the platforms like Twitter, Facebook, WhatsApp, and they mobilize their base, social bases, between middle-rank entrepreneurs, middle-rank bourgeoisie in Brazil, moving their followers and activating them for a huge, huge financial system. So I would say that Lula won't have many difficulty in the Congress, because the Congress is at least two-thirds of bench keepers and pork barrel who wants budget, but we'll have some difficulty to change Brazilian society, I would say so. Change the ideological part of the Brazilian society, more connected to the crime of against nature and more connected to the neo-Pentecostal churches, for example.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Looking at that, since you mentioned nature, Lula has promised more social and environmental responsibility, Arnold August. He has talked about how he's going to combat the destruction of the Amazon rainforest, which under, I'm sure you're aware, under Bolsonaro, it was heavily attacked in some respects.
Right.
I'm sorry if I'm using that word attack, but that's how some felt. And at this point, he wants to make Brazil a leader in the global climate talks. How much of that do you think he will pull through and actually honor a pledge that he has made?
Well, I think it may be difficult for him on the international scale, because a lot of important powers, even though they're congratulating or recognizing Lula has having won the election, they are still not really very much in favor of his policy. And I think, in my view, what will facilitate this whole program to change the policy on the Amazon deforestation is the international impact of Lula's victory last night. For example, if we just take North America and South America, the Lima Group, led by Canada and the United States, but based also in Argentina, Chile, Ecuador, Colombia, those four lost the elections a while ago, and yesterday Brazil lost Bolsonaro. So the Lima group is basically completely non-existent. And this is also, by the way, a repudiation of the Trudeau government.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Of course, Lima group. I mean, first of all, it was basically finished anyways before last night. But I guess we could say, excuse the expression, it was the last nail on the coffin of the Lima group. And as a repudiation, not only of the Trump-Biden policy, but it's also Justin Trudeau's policy with regards to Latin America. And I think that, I think it's very important. I mean, I guess we'll have chance. I think that one of the most important effects would be with regards to BRICS. I think you mentioned in passing. But before doing that, talking about Canada, now, it's very interesting that Canadian government, who attacks Iran with regards to its so-called violation of human rights regarding women, the same Trudeau government supported indirectly the coup against Dilma Rousseff, the first woman president of Brazil. So one has to take this into account as well. It's taking up a lot of ideological issues. One cannot look at Canada and its policy with regard to supporting the women in Iran. It is completely arbitrary.
Sure. Since you mentioned the Lima group, altogether, if you want to sum it up, Bruno, in terms of the win by Lula, it kind of consolidates what has been termed as this pink tide in Latin America, which I'm sure you heard of. And at this point, we're looking at how these countries have basically consolidated themselves in terms of governing all the region's major economies, and sort of a shift to the left. Now, what does that particularly say about the West, in particular the U.S. Presence and its financial system, which is dominated by the U.S., and of course its allies and institutions that are Washington-backed, like the World Bank or the IMF, because these countries did not reap the rewards that they were promised. Is this a repudiation of that, or saying no to that, and that's why we're looking at this pink tide, not complete with Brazil's Lula da Silva's win?
Yeah, I think you are right, because with Brazil, it is a possibility to reinforce in the South Bank and having connection to the BRICS Bank and getting rid of the dictatorship, the tyranny of the dollar. This is something that Lula would like to improve through his foreign minister, Celso Amorim. The other possibility is to make a reinforcement of the region between trading among us and not trading only for being an export country, a plantation country, or a mining country. I would say that for the regional and to getting rid of the dollar and the projection of power coming from the U.S., Brazil must have a center-left government or even a left government. Lula is a social democrat, but in the international system, he always will be an independent and more closer to the South, Latin America and Africa, for example. So it's a good position for us and a not-so-good position to U.S.
Okay. Well, you talked, actually, about BRICS there, Arnold August. Let's talk about that. Obviously, Brazil is one of the five members, which has India, Russia, China involved in that. And of course, we have Iran and Argentina who have applied for membership.
Right.
What? We have Saudi Arabia that's also interested in jumping on that bandwagon. So that obviously is not good news for the U.S. because it does not want, in particular, any country getting close to Russia, let alone China, which is the U.S.'s end game. So by this win, some are calling it like this headline: Lula's win is game changer for BRICS and Latin America. Is that something that you agree with? And at the same time, a big loss for the U.S. and the West?
Yeah, for sure. In fact, the first thing that came to my mind last night when it was announced formally that Lula won was not so much economic policy or environment, but this is a very important geopolitical change. If we just take BRICS, Russia, India, China, South Africa, these countries, and of course Brazil and Russia, these countries make up 40% of the world's population and 25% of the world GDP. Now, until last night, the only countries in the BRICS which we can say are like solidly against U.S. hegemony and had more or less progressive social programs domestically. All we had was Russia, China, and to a certain extent, South Africa, but not Brazil. Now, this is a game changer. The Brazilian delegation in BRICS is going to be led by the Lula government, which is very much against U.S. hegemony, has very close ties and support, for example, China, Venezuela, Cuba, et cetera. It's a game changer. And I'm glad that you mentioned that now the recent announcement that Iran and Argentina are going to join. This is very significant. For example, Iran, as you know, it is the second important, if I'm not mistaken, producer of gas, also has a lot of gold. And Argentina is another aspect of the world economy, soya and wheat, which is also very important. So by Lula coming into this, this mix with adding Iran and Argentina, sure, it completely changed, in my view, the political feature of BRICS. Like, in my view, for example, Iran, aside from having a very clear position against U.S. domination and interference, its social policy with regards to health, education, et cetera, including mm-hmm. women's rights, is very much underestimated.
Well, this is where the question mark comes in, Bruno, and that is the fact that we know, and you could probably tell us better, the fact that Lula wants, for example, a new Latin American currency. Let me come in at this angle, that he wants to create, called the SOR, which is not a new idea, but still it's something that he wants to do. And he has said publicly that he wants to lessen the dependence on the dollar. And at the same time, he has said we're going to try to recuperate the BRICS. Well, if he wants to do that, at the same time, he has said, some take that as being, well, he wants to distance himself from the U.S. But there are some that say, no, he's going to try to balance that out. But given the current political environment, that's not something that the U.S., you can do with the U.S., the way that the U.S. feels about Russia and also the way that the U.S. feels about China. And we know that Lula da Silva wants to enhance his relations with China. So which side are you on? Do you think that he's going to be able to balance the two out, or will he go pretty much on the BRICS group of countries, in particular China, and the shift to the east, as many have done around the world?
Well, in the geo-economical policies for abroad, Brazil must go as close as possible to the BRICS and to China and from Middle East. For the international system, he will try to make a balance and taking distance from U.S. And the Europe, subordinated to the U.S. and to the Five Eyes system countries. I would say that the South American currency, it is a possibility if we have a connection or a cooperation between our big oil companies like Petrobras, PDVSA, YPF in Argentina, EPFB in Bolivia. The other possibility is to reinforcing our industrial belts, because Brazil, for example, now only have 80% of his internal revenue, internal production from the industry. We would have 25% of this, of our richness in the 80s. So reinforcing the industry, creating new industries, for example, having a connection with Iran, with Khorasan, INOC, to taking fertilizing technology to Brazil. Fertilizing is very important to Brazil. Those key parts of the geo-economical, we must have as far as possible from U.S. In the international system, we go in the diplomatic way, in a pragmatic way, and be in a balance with U.S. and Europe. I would say so.
Okay. Well, since we just have time for maybe a question here, which will go to you, Arnold August. Looking at the list of priorities that Lula has, ensure that no Brazilian goes hungry, pledging to provide housing for the homeless, jobs, opportunities for the poor, better education, equality for women. I'm going to play bad cop here and say, you know, that's a tall order. Do you really think that he's going to be able to do that? And will it take a lot of time for him to achieve those goals?
Well, it definitely is a tall order because, as I mentioned, amongst other reasons, three of the most important states in terms of population is controlled by the Bolsonaro people. And so we will have to resist the pressure from them. And who knows, there also might be attempts to destabilize the situation in Brazil and to lead it, to make it extremely difficult for Lula to govern. I think it's going to be very difficult. And I think today it may be too early to really predict or say how he can develop those policies. But at the same time, one should not, in my view, get caught up with Lula as a personality. Very important. But one has to take into account that his position, his candidacy for president, was supported from the hard left, if you like, in Brazil, for example, the Brazilian Communist Party and the Communist Party of Brazil. So he has to also make sure this base is satisfied.
Bruno Bicklini, I have time for one more question to ask you in about 30 seconds. This Latin American integration is what Lula has talked about. How important is that? Will he be able to do that in order for the grouping of Latin American countries to move forward in the world when it comes to different aspects politically, especially in terms of the economies of that integration, as a result of that integration?
If we can establish our own currency, at least for trading, it is a possibility. If we stand together, if we stand alone and getting close to US or to Europe, it will be a lost chance again. Just like, for example, to finish, like IPF in Vaca Muerta, that make an agreement with Chevron and not with Petrobras. We must have the key opportunities and go together. This is a real possibility.
Thank you for that, Bruno Bicklini, academic and political scientist from Porto Alegre in Brazil. Arnold August, a pleasure. Thank you. Author and journalist from Montreal. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have an expert from the Islamic House of Qom, Hujjatul Islam, Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Karimi. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
That's all right. According to the text of the Holy Quran, so we have so many ayats in the Holy Quran and also historical facts that Prophet Ibrahim on a day was invited to a party out of a town or a celebration along with the people of his town. But he, we can say, pretended to be sick, stayed in the town, went to the main, we can say, worshipping place of the people of his town and broke all the idols made from stone and wood over there. And gradually, he himself, along with his son Ishmael, built Kaaba, which is nowadays the worshipping place for so many Muslims all across the world. First of all, I'd be happy with breaking the idols. You just give us a picture of what happened on that time. And why building a house which is made out of brick and stone again? Because the idols were made out of the stone and were broken away. Why, again, we can't say making a house which is made out of brick, stone, and wood and something like that? Isn't it a kind of idol worshipping itself?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, on that very specific day, according to the verses of the Quran and the narrations, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam broke all the idols except for the biggest one. And when the people asked him, he said that ask the big idol to answer you. And then they themselves confessed that it cannot talk. And he said that how you are worshipping an idol which cannot talk. So this was a practical lesson for those idol worshippers to tell them that you are worshipping idols made out of stones which cannot protect themselves and cannot talk. Now, there is a big difference between the idols and the holy house of God, the Kaaba. First of all, those people who say that the idols were made out of stone and the Kaaba is also out of stone, yeah, it might be true. But, the problem of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam was not the material, the stones. So can anyone say that why Prophet Ibrahim built a house for himself, by the stones? No. I mean, he could have demolished the idols even if they were made of, any other material other than the stones. Having said that, the first point is that, first of all, we should be noted that Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam was not the first person to build the Kaaba. No, Kaaba was built before him, and according to some people, it was first built by...